All right, well, I finally found the decaf Aldi coffee, so I am enjoying a beautifully warm drink in the evening that will hopefully not keep me up all night.
Awesome. I kind of wish I had actual caffeinated because I was at a wedding quite late last night, so we'll see how we go.
We'll have Brian at his best, I'm sure.
All right, folks, welcome to the Affix podcast. We only have bold statements in our paradiddle. I've been listening to too much Future of the Left, man. It's all right. So where we talk about, I don't know, the intelligentsia on the internet, and we make silly bets, and we talk about Diablo, and it's fantastic.
Whatever. All we do is just talk about whatever we talked on the podcast last time.
Well, we're getting there. We need to ladder up, you know?
I mean, the first podcast we talked about something, maybe that stuff. Now we just reflect back on whatever we talked about last week.
We'll get there one day. The percentages are increasing over time for sure, listeners. So, you know, right now is the perfect time to get in.
Yes. Don't let us drive you off. We have new stuff. You'll love it.
Just refer all your friends right now. This is the perfect entry point for anyone to listen to the Affix podcast.
There we go.
Right. So the typical show schedule goes, we do feedback to ourselves and from listeners. We pick a couple of blogs or whatever we've seen on the internet, maybe read a book. Not this week. And then we make bets and we talk Diablo. So we'll kick into it right now. I have ridiculously short amounts of feedback for myself this week.
Oh, good.
But it's feedback on feedback.
Oh, good.
So last week, I apologized because I had told Macrobio Boy that we had Dunkin' Donuts in Australia, but it turns out we didn't. But it turns out we did.
Oh, my God. How deep does this rabbit hole go?
So it turns out that Dunkin' Donuts exited Australia back in around 2006. Similar thing to what happened to Starbucks in Australia.
Yeah, so Starbucks famously had to leave because they couldn't cater to Australian tastes very effectively.
Yep. So they had a few franchises going around the major capitals being, I think it was mostly Sydney and Melbourne.
Canberra, the bustling metropolis of Canberra definitely had Starbucks, I remember.
Of course. It's a high wealth capital, so you want to be targeting that for sure. But yeah, we're just too snobby with our coffee in Australia, so they just couldn't hold on to that foothold, I guess.
That's actually not the story that I was told. The reason that Starbucks, I believe, didn't work in Australia is that Starbucks in the US is a real grab your coffee and walk to work kind of thing, whereas the Australian cafe culture is much more like, I want to sit down and have my coffee. And so Starbucks would very quickly fill up and then no one would buy coffee from them anymore because they're like, oh, there's no seats, we'll go to the other cafe. So their whole business model was predicated on like churning people through as fast as they possibly could, selling them the coffee and getting them out the door. And when they, you know, they got reduced volumes because everyone wanted to sit around and hang out in Starbucks, they couldn't make the profit they were used to, which is why they had to ditch it.
That is so funny to me because, like, I don't know, I've been to a few Starbucks in my time. The main memory I have of Starbucks was it was the only cafe that seemed to open before 8 a.m. in Amsterdam, which was ridiculous. Like, I don't understand how you can have a city like Amsterdam where cafes don't open at like 6 in the morning. It's ridiculous.
Wow.
Anyway, so I sat in a Starbucks because I was starting work ridiculously early over there for a big company, consulting for them, and I just sat in Starbucks for a good 2 hours waiting for the main offices to open while I drank a coffee and worked away on my laptop there because, you know, jet lag and all that stuff.
Sure.
And it seemed like a pretty comfortable space, so it seemed, I don't know.
Yeah, I do think they make comfortable spaces. I think that's part of the aesthetic. They just don't expect anyone really to use it. And when Australians did, they were very surprised and they couldn't make any money.
It's all just for show. It's just signaling.
I mean, maybe it's signaling. I mean, look at you sitting there, signaling.
So that's it. So I wasn't a liar. Dunkin' Donuts was in Australia, particularly at a time when I had gone to Melbourne quite a bit. I think my regularity of going to Melbourne was probably at its peak.
Sure. That's probably why I thought it existed. You haven't left your house since mid-2019, right? You saw sort of COVID on the horizon and haven't left your house since. Is that correct?
Yeah, in my hermit's shack out in the bush.
Yeah, that's my understanding of your life, particularly since I left.
Yeah. I apologize to myself. I apologize to everyone. I actually even came up with this theory when I was first talking to the listeners who were like, I don't think Dunkin' Donuts is in Australia. And then I failed to check it until after I apologized last week.
Got to keep that content mill going. Otherwise, what would you have to talk about during this section?
Well, you know, scout mindset. When you doubt yourself, sometimes you need to second check it.
I am having that. This is one of my feedback. So we bet on Porsche Caymans the other week because that is what I have been lusting after for a year, just as a fun side hobby. It is nice when you are going through horrors in life to have something fun to focus on. And we bet that the price would be going down. And so one thing that I want to say is, like, I saw the price going up. Like, when I was looking at them, I'm like, they're getting more expensive. This seems ridiculous. Like, I could see it happening in real time. But I couldn't convince myself that this was a thing that happened to secondhand cars and that the default is secondhand cars depreciate and they go down in price. So if I just wait, it'll keep getting cheaper. I was watching them get more expensive in real time, but I would not believe my own data analysis. And I put a lot of statistics into this. And so now they're more expensive. Like, I could have bought a Porsche a year ago and now sold it for a profit. And I could have been driving a Porsche for a year.
Missed opportunities.
So, you know, maybe if I was better calibrated, I would have backed myself and be like, nope, I'm right about this and I can make some money and have some fun at the same time.
I mean, I definitely picked March last year through until September. I'm like, Bitcoin, cryptocurrency should really be seeing a good amount of flow into it with the rest of the capital markets going up. And it didn't kick in until October.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, that epistemic humility, exactly as we talked to last week, it holds us back, man.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I'm going to write these things down so that I don't get them wrong. I look back in hindsight, I'm like, oh, man, I sure was wrong about that, so that I can better calibrate myself. Because it's easy to view the misses, the things that I was wrong about. Maybe I don't remember those anymore.
Yep, that's totally true.
So on the Porsche, so I did go and talk to the Porsche dealership over the weekend, and I had a bet. I'm like, nah, they're definitely going down because everyone's going to buy new Porsches. It's everyone's got loads of money, and the secondhand market won't be that hot anymore. And the Porsche dealership's like, yep, there's no computer chips for cars anymore. So a lot of car dealerships are pulling, or not a lot of car dealerships, some car dealerships are pulling out of Australia. There is over a 12-month wait on the 911, which is Porsche's most popular sports car. I'm buying a weird one that no one likes. So it doesn't sound like there's going to be a whole lot of new stock available. So I reckon those secondhand ones will stay high. So I think that is another coffee bet that I'm about to lose.
Well, we've still got 7 months in the year, you know. It's time.
We'll see. Did you like I put all the analysis together for you? Are you amenable to my multi-axis regression model and how to price accurately Porsche Caymans?
I'm amenable to it as long as we read the variable names correctly. Because, yeah, when I was first reading it.
Yeah, I did swap it. I'm like, wait a minute, they are getting cheaper. I'm like, that just doesn't feel right. I'm sure that doesn't feel right. But yeah, I just named them. I just said it's wrong because I'm an idiot.
Classic. So the one other piece of feedback I had was just to clarify for listeners why I hedged and why we always hedge when we're mentioning like social science or social psychology research, especially. So I said, you know, some people don't believe what Angela Duckworth has to say, that kind of thing. And there was a really great link from Tyler Cowen this week on Marginal Revolution to a website called Replication Index, running through a meta-analysis of all the claims made in Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman.
Oh, I meant to read that one, but then I lost it.
I'll send you the link. I've got it saved here, so you can check that out yourself when you put it in the show notes. And so Thinking Fast and Slow was a book I read, I think it came out 2011. I read it around 2015, and it was like a revelation to me. It was so amazing. There were all these like cool insights around different biases that we have. And then this meta-analysis is like, well, chapter 4 is complete garbage. Just throw it completely out. And then for the rest of it, the last chapter, where he's hedging himself the most around claims about happiness and what drives happiness, that is the most reliable. Everything else is kind of like a coin flip as to whether it would replicate or not.
Really?
Yep.
Wow.
This is the pervasiveness of the replication crisis in social psychology.
So people don't know, Kahneman and Tversky sort of pioneered the study of behavioral economics, they call it, which is the mix between psychology and economics, and won a Nobel Prize for it. They're like hugely, hugely influential in the fields of both psychology and economics. And I would say that rationality is just people discovering Kahneman's work like 20 years late. Like that's what I thought I went through the sequences, which is the founding basis of the whole movement of which Julia arguably leads. So do we have to cancel the podcast, I guess, is my next question.
I don't know. It's just, I feel like it's appropriate that we hedge ourselves and we call it out and say, yep, just be skeptical of what you hear about social psychology and power poses and all that kind of stuff.
I know only that I know nothing, I suppose.
Yeah, I think it's like there's so much in the world that there's a nice pointer and it's like this may shed light and it might be a nice mental framework to work with, but just don't rely on it. Don't like take that as a given, which probably goes well towards what Julia talks about in the Scout Mindset anyway, right? Hold yourself loosely.
Yep, hold your views lightly. Hold your identity loosely. Be willing to be wrong. It's the only way to ultimately become right. But man, is it really hard to be right anyway. Maybe it would be nicer if I just felt right all the time, even if I wasn't. I'm not sure.
And I better just clarify so I don't have to have further feedback next week.
Now, what are we going to talk about next week then?
This meta-analysis on Thinking Fast and Slow from Daniel Kahneman isn't like a review of all Daniel Kahneman's previously published and peer-reviewed papers. Thinking Fast and Slow was kind of his own overview of the field of biases in social psychology. So a lot of the work was not his own. So don't just dismiss his Nobel Prize in economics out of hand. And prospect theory, I think, still holds up.
Okay. Are we going to take it off him anyway then? We'll give it to Tyler. I like Tyler.
All right.
While we're talking about Julia, that is an excellent segue into my next bit of feedback, because I missed one of my favorite stories from the book, which is on you must be careful not to fool people, and particularly yourself, because you are the easiest person to fool. And she's got this excellent story. So during the 90s, there was a bit of a debate in the physics realm about whether the expansion of the universe was speeding up or slowing down, whether the universe would endlessly expand forever and keep getting further and further away, or ultimately it would all collapse back in on itself into the Big Crunch, as they like to call it, which is the opposite of the Big Bang, which is funny. I like that. That's funny. So a prestigious scientist of some kind called Sol Perlmutter ran the Supernova Cosmology Project, which was designed to collect a whole lot of data in order to prove which direction this would go. And what he did is he had a hunch. I think he had his hunch that the universe was going to continue to expand, but he knew that there was this data is going to be noisy and messy, and there's going to be a lot of different ways of like, oh, we'll count that as an outlier, or we'll cut it this way, or we'll cut it that way. And all of these decisions that you make in data analysis can add up to drastically influence the result. So what he did is he got all the data and like generated a random number in the background and just subtracted it from all or added it from all. And he didn't know what it was. None of his team knew what it was. It's just before they got to look at any raw data, they would just add this factor to it. So they knew that the result was going to be really close to zero. And it was either going to be slightly bigger than zero and the universe is expanding, or it was going to be slightly lower than zero. So it was going to be squishing, crunching. So they just put a tiny bit of noise in it. So like if it was bigger than zero, it could just be because this random factor was added to it. Or if it was smaller than zero, it could just be because this random factor was subtracted to it. So they couldn't like, oh, I really want it to be bigger than zero. So I'm just going to call that little one an outlier and then I'll get the result that I want. So because there was no way to know where they would be. So they did the whole analysis. And I think months worth of analysis on this really big data set. And then finally they figured out the number, which was, I don't know, he gave it to his dog or something to guard. I'm not sure. I'm talking off the cuff here. But yeah, and then took that number away, and I'm pretty sure figured out that the universe was expanding. And I'm like, that's such a genius way, is that you can do all this numerical analysis without being able to fool yourself, because you don't know, like, if you're making the numbers bigger or smaller, you could be getting the opposite value. So you've really sort of got to be truthful with yourself.
Yeah. When you first told me that anecdote, it was just a fascinating implementation of just anti-biasing tools in data science.
Yeah,
in very primitive data science as well.
Yes, yep, for sure.
So
I did that in a Python notebook in a day now. I'm very smart.
Sorry. Great stuff. I like a little hack, and that was a really nice one.
That's an excellent hack. It's an excellent awareness of yourself. It must be quite difficult to do, because, you know, I don't like to admit that I have biases. Like, I lived this whole mindset. I loved the Scout mindset as a book. I lived this whole thing, but I sort of still like, well, now that I've acknowledged them, they're all accounted for and I don't have them anymore, right?
Yeah.
So being able to step out of yourself and like, no, I'm still going to have the biases, so I've got to really make this very firm that I'm not doing it, is pretty impressive. I think that I just thought that was a really cool story. I don't know if it happens more often, but that was an excellent example of it in practice.
Nice.
And I sure hope you didn't find out that the universe is shrinking, because I know we'll get feedback on that. I hope I've got it the wrong way around.
No, I think the current consensus is heat death of the universe rather than Big Crunch.
Okay, phew. That'll be much more fun. I'm looking forward to it already.
I think the interesting thing was if it was going to be a Big Crunch, then entropy would theoretically reverse and then time might flow backwards.
Yeah, anyway. Then we could do it all again, but in reverse. Maybe that would be better. I'm not sure how I feel about this now. I'm going to analyze a whole lot of data with a slightly biased eye to get the answer that I want.
See, now I've come out with the speculation so someone can correct me instead of you. It's all good.
Always taking one for the team. Thank you, Brian.
Cool. And any other feedback?
Just the last one. I've just been sort of wanting to fit this into the show somewhere. And we talked about Russ Roberts last week. And, you know, like I say, we listen to a lot of people and we don't agree with all of them. And I love Russ Roberts and he's got an excellent mind and a strong view of the world. But he just threw in one of his recent podcasts this anecdote of like, oh, yeah, whenever anyone would say the minimum wage is a good idea at the dinner party, I would just lecture them how they're objectively wrong. And there is no debate. And the minimum wage is a bad thing. And we should immediately abolish it. It hurts everyone. It hurts poor people. It hurts rich people. It hurts economies. It's just a terrible mistake that no one should ever do. And I'm like, are you crazy? Like, I can sort of understand the arguments for there not being a minimum wage. And to spell those out, in case you have not heard them, like, if you really, really need the money because I don't know, you just can't afford bread for your family. And I have a job, which is like a pretty crappy job, and it's very, very low value to me. And you say, you know what? It's worth it to me. I actually need this money so badly that I will work for an hour for $2. And I'm like, well, this is only really going to generate $3 of value for my business. So, yep, $2 seems like a fair price to me. But if I had to pay you $4, I'm just not going to pay you anything. So you will get $0 in total. And so you would be happy with the $2. I would be happy paying you the $2 because I get $3 out of it. And as a good capitalist, I'm trying to make a profit. And the government says, no, you both are not allowed to be happy. And this will be illegal. And so instead, you must starve and you can't get the bread. And instead, you capitalists can't make a profit. And everyone goes home sad. That's sort of the, I don't know whether it's a straw man argument.
Yeah.
But that's the very basic reason as to why a minimum wage would be bad, is that it's essentially two adults who are, in theory, of right mind, willing to make a deal and that would benefit them both, or they wouldn't be willing to make that deal. And the government comes in and says, this deal is illegal, you're not allowed to do it. And I'm like, there's so many factors in an economy that drive differences in that I do feel like a minimum wage, if nothing else, for setting sort of default standards on we don't pay people $2 an hour and force them to work 100 hours a week to feed their family, probably is a net benefit. I don't know. I'm not saying, like, you could probably convince me of anything. That was the whole point of the book last week. So you could convince me that the minimum wage is a bad idea, but I'm like, the idea that it's just fait accompli, this is the correct economic stance, that it is always a bad idea and you're a terrible person for believing otherwise, he's crazy. He's crazy, man. Russ Roberts is definitely crazy.
There was a nice overview, biased overview, but nice overview nonetheless. In Planet Money this week, they had an overview of the history of, maybe it wasn't Planet Money, maybe it was Freakonomics. Let me have a quick look.
Both podcasts much more highly produced than ours, listeners. If you're bored of the two guys in their bedrooms talking to each other format and you want something with music and little interludes and interviews and actual reporting, you could listen to either of those. But I think we have a chump, Baron.
Yeah, well, we've got music and little interviews.
Oh, we do have music. Actually, when I upload us onto YouTube, we got copyright strikes on our music, so I sort of feel like I need to look into that a little bit.
That's concerning.
Because we bought our music copyright free and commissioned it specifically for this podcast.
Yeah, definitely look into that. Anyway, it was the Freakonomics podcast. So Freakonomics podcast this week had a good overview of the history of the minimum wage and, yeah, a few people talking about it, which was interesting. Good to see a bit of back and forth there. Yeah, the history of the theory of the minimum wage stuff from an economic study point of view back in the 60s through to about the 80s when they weren't big on actually collecting data and doing that kind of detailed data science-y analysis was very theory-based and was the minimum wage is stupid. What are you, dumb?
Right, okay.
And then, yeah, a bunch of different analyses have taken place since then and it's a lot more ambiguous as to how it works out. As with so many things in life.
As with so many things. But I mean, even the analyses that I've seen, and I have not listened to this podcast, the analyses that I would see, the other strong argument against the minimum wage is that it will lead to higher unemployment, that there are some people who can't produce value greater than $6 an hour or whatever the minimum wage is in America, and so they will just be jobless, which is obviously worse for them because being jobless is quite depressing.
Yep.
And I can almost lean slightly on the case that the minimum wage will lead to slightly higher unemployment, but I still think that the trade-off is like social safety net should just catch those people and the people who can work should be paid a living wage. I think that that could still easily be a net benefit to society. Again, complicated, could be convinced either way. We'll read into it probably for the rest of my life and, you know, have something to talk about on this podcast. But even if it leads to some unemployment, I still think the minimum wage is a good idea.
Yeah. I'm not going to turn this into the minimum wage podcast, so I'm going to be like, yep, cool. All right. Mostly agree.
Brian's already got a topic in mind and he's just champing at the bit to get it.
Nah. It's just I haven't researched enough on the minimum wage other than...
Is it possible to research enough on the minimum wage? I don't, this is why I say this is going to be a debate till the end of the podcast, because I'm sure there will be new studies and new things to talk about on it.
Yeah, exactly. I think your point on having an anchor point there goes back to our conversation on laws, which is very nice. Episode 2, should we even have laws?
Just setting the expectation. It's like, if you're the cheapest possible worker, you get paid X dollars an hour, rather than it's always a negotiation. It's like, oh, will you work for a dollar? Will you work for $1.50?
All right, I'm going to lean into this conversation now, just because I can't help myself.
Good.
My thought there, right, is one, that's nice because you're setting that base expectation for what people should be looking for and that kind of thing.
Yep.
But also it's very nice from the capitalist's perspective to say, don't bother wasting your time, please, looking for opportunities that are only worth $6 an hour. Go out and find the big opportunities that have good marginal product in the world to labor.
Yeah, I mean, sure. Yeah. Don't put people in jobs that can only generate $6 an hour worth of value.
Yep. You're smarter than these capitalists. You can figure it out. Stop wasting your time on those piddly little things.
Yeah. Possibly it's just slumlords and bad people that are looking for those marginal edges.
Exactly.
That is an interesting point and not even one that I had thought of. I like it.
All right, good. I'm glad that I can finish on a positive point.
All right, well, you're not allowed to get into your section yet because we got a new patron.
Yes.
And so that means we have to thank all our patrons. So we are up to 9 patrons now, which is awesome. So if you would like to be the one that kicks us over to double digits, we would be extremely grateful for that. That would be pretty cool. But if you just want to keep listening for free, like, honestly, I'm finding making this podcast extremely gratifying. We keep growing. You refer us to our friends. They listen. We get more and more downloads pretty much every week. It's awesome. I'm having a lot of fun. Thank you so much, listeners.
Yeah, thank you so much, everyone. And do keep referring us. It's just great to see those numbers keep going up. Nothing like watching numbers go up. It's so satisfying. Well, going down sometimes in certain metrics, but mostly the numbers getting bigger.
Usually I'm looking to make numbers bigger, but for my weight and for my race times, I like those to get smaller.
Yeah, I mean, I watch speedruns, right? So getting those numbers smaller is always very fun.
That's the goal.
But for listeners, make them bigger,
listeners,
all right?
Bigger, more listeners. More listeners is what we're looking for.
More listeners, more feedback. You can reach out to us at podcastaffix@gmail.com or affixpodcast@gmail.com.
Well, and genuinely, one of those goes to Brian and one of those goes to Chris, but I'm not going to tell you which is which.
Very nice. And apparently you can just stumble across Chris on Reddit sometimes, occasionally plugging the podcast and say, good work, Chris.
Thank you very much, Pythagoras and Python. That was extremely nice. Was it Pythagoras and Python?
Plato and Python.
Thank you very much, Plato and Python. It was just so nice for you to find me on Reddit and message me. That's like, that genuinely made my day.
Okay, while we're talking about more downloads and watching the numbers get bigger, I'm going to quickly segue into my other secret topic.
Oh no, I'm not prepared.
Which is
for
a very
this.
Quick topic, I'm sure. I was listening to the Exponent podcast this week, which is Ben Thompson and James Alworth, who we've previously referenced on the show. And Ben Thompson wrote another post about it on his blog Stratechery this week about podcasting and Spotify and Apple's announcements for paid podcasts. We're not going to make you pay for this podcast, first of all, listeners. All right? We're not on that model. We just rely on generosity.
And our day jobs.
Mostly that, yeah. They're much more lucrative than this, I assure you. But it was just very interesting to me hearing Ben talked through the model of podcasting on Spotify, and it seemed so incredibly obvious to me when I heard it, but I'd never actually thought it through, which is listens on Spotify won't ever show up like in our webpage statistics because Spotify just streams them, like they download the file and stream it through their own thing.
I don't think that's true. I'm pretty sure I can get our Spotify statistics right now. I think they get reported back.
Interesting. Do they roll back in separately or do they add into the standard Buzzsprout data that you get?
If we go to our stats, I'm pretty sure I can see our listens on Spotify. Apple Podcast number one, Podcast Addict number two. Who's listening on the Podcast Addict? I don't know who you are, listeners. And this is not like a big podcast app. No one else's podcast is being downloaded through the Podcast Addict, but you guys out there, you love the Podcast Addict, so maybe I should check it out.
Is it Android?
I guess so. I don't know. The next one's Pocket Cast, which is the one that I listen to it on. And possibly like all of those downloads are just me because I love this podcast so much. And then Overcast, which is your favorite podcast app. And then Spotify.
How interesting. So there you go. There's a quick roundup of how people go about listening to our podcast, folks. But that was just an interesting point. Okay, so that's interesting to hear that it's captured separately. But would that mean it's hitting our bandwidth that we pay for? That our Patreons pay for?
No, I don't think so. So our pricing model is we pay per hour that we upload, and I think that can go into an unlimited number of customers, is my understanding.
Yeah, cool.
So we get indefinite hosting of all the podcasts. We upload about 4 hours a month, so I'm on the 5 hour a month tier, or maybe it's the 10 hour a month tier because it went from 2 to 10, something like that. I don't remember. I feel like I tried to choose the most cost-effective tier for us, and we can get unlimited downloads on that, and it gets a lot of nice stuff. Like, it gives us all these stats, so that's how I can pull up all these numbers so easily. So possibly if I was really resourceful, I could roll our own podcast hosting and put it in everything for like $10 a month, but this seems well worth it to me.
Cool. There you go. We're all learning this at the same time, listeners, because I don't actually look at any of the back-end stuff. Chris, on top of writing excellent show notes, handles all of that for me. I just do the editing.
Did I give you the password? I keep it secret.
Keep it secret, man. Whatever.
Okay. The secret is no one listens. I just like to boost your ego by telling you all these numbers. It's just you and me here. But it's still my favorite podcast, so hopefully that's good enough for you.
All right, aficionados. So we got a very interesting one for you this week. An author who we might have briefly mentioned once upon a time in the very early episodes, but I don't think we've ever talked about his actual writings, Robin Hanson. So I found this week's article, which is called Experts versus Elites, through a link in a link from Zvi Mashawitz's blog this week on coronavirus, and it was just fascinating to me. So before we get into the actual topic, I want to have a kind of meta level discussion about Robin Hanson with Chris, because he's just, he deserves an introduction.
Possibly even more crazy than Russ Roberts, I would argue.
I would say definitely crazier than Russ Roberts, and definitely more out there than Brian Kaplan, who we had many discussions about for sure.
Yes, Brian Kaplan's at least got some charisma. I think that Robin Hanson does not have much.
Yeah, he's got some amazing ideas, though.
He's got some ideas.
I think probably the biggest thing to like establish credibility for Robin Hanson would be, first of all, to say anyone out there who has heard of the Fermi paradox, which is we're out here in the universe, why aren't we seeing alien life?
Yep, there's so many planets, and they've been around for so long. If there was even a minute chance of intelligent life evolving, and there must be at least a minute chance, otherwise we wouldn't be here, where the hell are all the aliens?
Yeah. And I don't know, since I, probably a couple of years after I first heard of the Fermi paradox, you quickly stumble into a few of the theorized answers to it. And one of the answers is the great filter. So something just happens in civilizations that has a very high probability of just wiping out all life on their planet.
We don't have to be the most depressing about the great filter. I mean, the great filter, yes, is the reason why we don't see alien life, isn't it? It's much, much harder than we think. But the great filter could be behind us. It could be that multicellular life, the jump from single cellular to the multicellular life is incredibly difficult. Or it could be that the jump from primate level intelligence to human level intelligence is incredibly, incredibly rare. So there is lots and lots of life out there, but they're just a bunch of giraffes or sharks or whatever, and they're just sort of swimming around eating each other, etc.
So like if you look back in history, sorry, you're right, I have taken the next level depressing view of it. It could be that we're already past the great filter, because the great filter could be the carbon collapse that happened X billion years ago, where the entire planet was just covered in trees because there was nothing that could actually eat the carbon that trees capture.
Yep.
And the planet was just saturated with oxygen, and there was infinitely burning fires, and eventually some bacterium evolved to eat the tree's carbon, and that could be the breakthrough through the great filter, right?
Yeah. But yes, depressingly, the great filter could be ahead of us. And, you know, plausibly the great filter was the invention of nuclear weapons, right? And that any advanced civilization powerful enough to split the atom just immediately destroys itself through some kind of war where they just drop a thousand bombs on each other, like plausibly could have happened multiple times during the Cold War.
Yep, exactly. And I think that was probably the first big explanation of the great filter I heard, was the whole nuclear war theory. But that theory, you tell me, Chris, was first posited by Robin Hanson.
Yes, apparently. I only found this out a few weeks ago myself. And I would have believed that was posited by Fermi himself, who was like, you know, an absolute genius. Yeah, it felt like such a core part of the theory that it was Enrico Fermi himself who posited it. But it's a Robin Hanson edition. So there's no doubting that Robin Hanson is smart. No doubt at all in my mind.
Yeah, but at the same time, Robin Hanson also just, he's had this blog, Overcoming Bias, running for, what, 2 decades now? Maybe longer?
Yeah, it's a long-running one.
And when I click around randomly in those archives, I can grok a few of the posts there. I can understand a few more. And there's some that are just absolutely impenetrable to me.
He's got his own unique interests. He talks a lot about signaling, which we're going to get onto with this elites discussion. He's recently been talking a lot about aliens, and he's just, I don't know, there's multiple ways to read it. It could be that he's just going where his mind goes.
Sorry, let me just interrupt and just reinforce there, people. Aliens, okay?
Aliens.
Seriously entertaining the concept of aliens. And I'm not like dissing it, because I've been around the conversation for long enough, but just there's the whole History Channel meme thing about ancient aliens, and that's all I can think of every time I stumble across these posts.
That level of crazy. He definitely feels that level of crazy. Yeah, so you can read him as just an incredibly intelligent man who's socially awkward and just takes his mind wherever it wants to go. But he's always talking about prestige and signaling, and so signaling, status signaling, basically, is what he loves to talk about more than anything, I would say. This is his core theory about the world. And sometimes it can read as like he didn't quite get the job that he really thought he won, or not as many people go to his talks as he wants. And he's like, well, it's not that I'm stupider than those people. They're just higher status with their stupid signaling, with their charisma and their sports cars and their fancy Ivy League degrees. And that's the only reason that anyone pays attention to them and not me. Not at all because I'm crazy and talk about aliens.
Yeah. And I don't know, I wouldn't put him in the camp of crazy. He's just...
Sorry, I use crazy loosely. I just mean people disagree with me when I say crazy.
Yeah, but I will just like reinforce, he's not crazy, but he definitely has ideas that are outside of the standard deviation of creativity. That is probably the easiest way to put it.
Yeah, he's interesting. That's why I sometimes read him. I do find his posts are some of the easiest to skip when I read the first couple of paragraphs. I'm like, oh, God, I don't know where this is going. And then I blow through them quite a bit. But he's changed the way I think about the world. I definitely think he has changed the way I think about the world sometimes.
This is my meta theory on Robin Hanson, which is don't sign up on an RSS feed or anything like that to Robin Hanson. Don't follow Robin Hanson. Just go to Robin Hanson when other smart people are pointing towards him.
Right. You mean Tyler. You just mean Tyler. I don't know why I read blogs.
No, because I found
Tyler's
him through his feed this time. All right.
Oh, that's so true.
If Tyler mentions him, if Scott Aronson mentions him, if Scott Siskind from Slate Star Codex mentions him, follow those links and definitely read Robin Hanson. But don't click through any of the other archives.
Yeah, when he's good, he's very good. He's just got an unusual way of reading the world, and some of his stuff can be impenetrable for sure.
Yep. So back to the main topic on it now that we've had that sort of meta level discussion. The article I want to refer to was from February this year called Experts versus Elites, and it's kind of a general musing on what defines elites, and when you talk about those ivory tower elites and they're kind of having their big left-wing conversations trying to steer the discourse and the culture and blah, 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 and it all sounds so insidious, and it's kind of trying to pick apart probably the easiest way to put this, and he comes up with it in the article itself, is opening with the view on how COVID has played out. And there's been a lot of input into the public conversation from quote-unquote experts and saying we should follow the science and blah, blah, blah. But what you actually see is someone at a senior political level will make a decision and the expertise will then shift to follow that decision.
Line up behind the elite. So the elite being usually a political leader, sometimes a journalist leader, like the New York Times journalist plausibly could put into the elite category, will make a decision and then all the experts will fall into line behind them and say, yes, this is what the science said all along. We always thought that.
Yeah, which is kind of a conversation we had back when we did talk about Zvi's writing in the very first episode of this podcast. So an opening quote from the piece that sort of gets to this point is, as we saw early in the pandemic, the elites are always visibly chattering amongst themselves about the topics of the day, and when they form a new opinion, these experts quickly cave to agree with them and pretend that they agreed all along. So it's like the experts are the people who are working on the problems, and they should have the most detailed understanding of any particular issue. And, you know, if you look at a general organization, you'll have the individual contributors who are working away at problems, and then you'll have the management and the leadership within the organization who make the big strategic decisions. And sometimes leadership will overrule what the people on the bottom level are doing in any organization. I'm sure pretty much anyone listening to this has experienced that. And it's not just a matter of expertise knows what's best. Sometimes there are judgment calls made at a leadership level. And I think that's what he's trying to pick apart here, is where do those roles lie?
Yeah, certainly that's a bit of it. I think, I mean, he has a dim view of, or not a dim view of elites, but he sort of thinks elites are not chosen for necessarily their intelligence, but they're chosen for all the things that we like in people, their charisma and their drive and their fancy degrees and the places they've worked, like, you know, places like Harvard accrue prestige, but they also imbue prestige. Once you're a Harvard grad, we've talked about this before, you are just a more prestigious person inherently because of your association with Harvard. And once you're a Goldman Sachs banker, you are just inherently a more prestigious person because you're a Goldman Sachs banker. And the way these institutions, did you go back one link further deep, which of like, who are the elites? He references a paper which looked into how these super elite firms tend to hire people. And a lot of it is based on charisma and drive and wit and these extracurricular activities where you're like, you went and helped orphans in sub-Saharan Africa or something. And you're never allowed to say that I did this because it's really prestigious and I think it will help. But you have to say, oh, no, I just have an intense feeling for how to do these things, or that I have to do these things to help the world. And it just happened to get me a bunch of prestige points, which is going to get me this really, really high-paying job directly out of university.
Yeah, which Brian Kaplan would frame as social desirability bias, that you're not allowed to actually frame it that way. Yeah, I kind of see that point. That's probably my big reading in this is all of Robin's writing on this topic seems to have a really negative perception of that and like try to paint it negatively. But when I actually read it, I'm like, you know what, Robin? those things are good. Like, it takes belief in people to follow leaders. Just because you have the expertise doesn't mean you have the ability to communicate in a way that people will want to listen. And I think he highlights that in so many points of this article, but he's just actually not grokking it himself.
Yeah, sure. And so the other thing that he would say leaders do is, like, you may be an expert in one thing, but you're not an expert in everything. And so the leader or the elite or whatever you want to call them during this conversation should be able to take in input from a variety of experts in a variety of different fields and say, here is the best synthesis of these ideas, right? This would be, again, in the medical establishment. It's like, this is the problem they think about all day, every day. So they're like, everyone, even not during a pandemic, just to prevent the flu, should be sanitizing every door handle every time they touch it, because they're a super expert. And they're like, we can cut thousands of deaths per year if you just, every time you walk through a door, you immediately squirt it with alcohol and you give it a rub. And like, how easy is that? It's the really easy thing. But none of us do that. Like, for a little while during COVID, maybe we did that. But during the flu season, we're like, eh, whatever, risk I'll take. And so if you leave those people, that expert in that really niche field, they're going to nail it. They're going to absolutely nail their field, and they're going to give good advice on how to fix their exact problem. But they're going to create a huge number of other problems that they haven't thought about because they're not experts in everything.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like, the overall synthetic view from the top level. And exactly as I talked to at the start, like, there are strategic decisions to be made in running a business or running an economy or, you know, running government bureaucracies as well. That you need to be able to factor these things in. And I feel like I say this a lot in this podcast, and I feel like I have to bring him up every time, which is annoying because I don't think it's really Simon Sinek, but it's kind of the story.
This book had a real impact on you.
It's annoying. Like, I don't know how who else to like frame it in, but it's just like being able to tell a compelling story and get people to follow instructions through a compelling story is the role of leadership.
Yeah, yep, absolutely. Particularly at those senior levels. Or leadership as opposed to management, perhaps you could put.
Yeah, and like Robin makes this point in here that, oh, we talk about promoting people who have the expertise, but we don't always do that. And you know why we don't do that? Because they're not good people leaders. They don't know how to tell a good story. They don't know how to listen to the people reporting to them. Sometimes they can be really experts at the fine detail modes, but they can't zoom out and make a strategic decision and do that synthesis like you talk to. Or they can be too risk averse, I suppose, or not have that kind of tolerance for risk that those kind of higher level elite roles require.
Yep. And so on the other side, I would say, Brian is an elite. He is a leader of many, many people. And I have always been an individual expert. And people listen to me because I'm very bright, but I've always been an expert. I liked, did you read the Nate Silver quote, which I think was in the very original article, of like the Johnson & Johnson pause, which has happened in the US due to the blood clots. And at the time, many, many vaccine experts are like, are you kidding? It's like 6 blood clots and 1 death compared to hundreds a day. Many experts were saying this. And everyone, you know, during the Trump administration era, is like, why aren't you listening to the experts? We're science. We like science. Why aren't you listening to the scientists? And then Joe Biden's like, no, we're blocking the Johnson & Johnson thing because of these blood clots. And all the experts are screaming like, this is a terrible idea. Many more people will die. But it's like, no, we don't listen to the experts now. We listen to the elite. The elite's on our team now. So we're going to listen and do what the elite says, even though he maybe doesn't know what the hell he's talking about.
Oh, yeah. What's the marginal revolution term that always is referenced here? Mood affiliation?
Mood affiliation, yeah. Now that my guy's in charge, everything must be good, so we don't really have to worry about those experts anymore. It's only when the experts agree with me and disagree with my political enemies that it's really important we listen to experts. Otherwise, we just do whatever my team says.
Yep.
What so I don't classic. Think that elites are universally good. I think that's what Robin Hanses is trying to bring out, is that experts do actually have the domain knowledge and the elites often do not, and sometimes listening to the elites is just because they're prestigious and they've made a decision which may be very ill-informed, which I think it was in this case. If you look at the reason given of why we had to pause the Johnson & Johnson vaccine was because of vaccine hesitancy. There's all these, you know, anti-vax people or people who are worried about the speedy timeline of the development of the vaccine, and if we didn't take every possible precaution, and when there's 6 blood clots, we'll pause everything and stop the whole rollout of the vaccine, they'll stop taking it, and we really have to show how trustworthy we are. And what has ended up happening is, due to this pause, the amount of vaccinations are plummeting because everyone's like, wait a minute, you're dangerous enough to pull it off the shelves? Well, I don't want any of the other ones. When are you going to pull them off the shelves?
Yeah, yeah. It's been infuriating a few people around the circles that we read, that's for sure.
Yes, particularly Zvi. Zvi doesn't like it at all.
No.
Or anyone. Yeah, I mean, it's been a disastrous decision. And like, for, you know, all the vaccine approvals need double-blinded experiments of everything, but someone comes up with some general theory of public psychology of like, oh, we need to be careful so that people will trust us. No experimentation, no data, just someone's hunch. And because they're the elite, they get to make the call with no pushback. And here it goes. And it's been a disaster.
Yeah. Which they're not the public talking elite. They are the bureaucratic elite. They're the deep state.
I don't know where the decision ultimately came from.
But yeah, no, that's an interesting point. I think while we're talking about like the downsides of the elite, I like saying that as much as I am.
Because you are one. Because you are one.
Well, like one of my questions to myself in reading this was like, Chris, did you make a starter podcast so we're like out there talking in the public domain and we're going to be elite?
I mean, that's the ultimate goal of this podcast, yes. I don't feel like I've ever made this hidden. Brian likes money and power. Chris likes money and status.
Yeah, the thing getting into this and also plays to my point on the elites, I don't necessarily buy everything that Robin Hanson is laying down about elites just have to come through these prestigious institutions or they have to be like good writers in the New York Times to have this voice in the public discourse or whatever. I honestly think that probably actually plays partly into the whole signaling theory, and not even signaling theory, it's like filtering theory. Those people would get to those elite positions regardless because they are charismatic, because they're effective communicators, because they're leaders, whether they were working in the New York Times or if they'd gotten a job as a lobbyist and somehow worked their way through into, I don't know, state politics or something like that. Like sure. they'd end up at a place where they have a voice in the public discourse regardless.
Right.
And that's because they are so charismatic and they know how to engage with people and get buy-in to affect change in that way. And that can play out well when they luck into having good decisions or they know how to synthesize knowledge well, but it can also play out really, really poorly. You know, what's the law where you invoke the Nazis?
Godwin's law.
Godwin's law. So I'm just going to leave that by the side there, but you know, just
certain charismatic Nazis may have caused some harm in the world at some point.
Indeed. And what it reminds me of, since this is the AFIX podcast and we just give you various things to look into, dear listeners, is there was a episode of Econ Talk with Russ Roberts and Agnes Callard probably 12 months ago when Agnes Callard's book on aspiration came out, and they had this big discussion in that podcast about recalibrating their minds to be wary of charisma. And like, if you are getting super engaged in a conversation, you're hearing it, when you walk away from that conversation, you're like, that was really charismatic and that person was super engaging. Maybe I should take their arguments less seriously.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like we need to, I don't know whether we made this point, but the point that Robin would making is that elites perhaps at a base level are chosen for that charisma, and charisma is at best not correlated with intelligence or expertise and possibly anti-correlated with these things. So the people who have all this power, and I agree, like to wield that level of power, you have to paint a vision, you have to get people bought along for the ride. No one can send rockets to Mars, as Elon Musk is doing, without having a whole thousands of engineers and staff working for them, and they're not going to work for them. You know, money goes so far, but you need a vision for them to buy into, particularly the hours that Elon works his stuff. So that level of charisma is how you get big things done, and I don't see a world where it can be done without that, but that's not necessarily correlated with the people who know the best things to do. Possibly there's some really smart nerds out there who have figured out the better things to do, but they can't convince anyone.
Possibly one of those is Robin Hanson.
Well, but I definitely think he thinks he's that.
That's fair. What were my other highlights in there? So talking around this, he also has a point about when an academic wins a Nobel Prize, they've achieved a pinnacle of expertise, at which point they often start to wax philosophic and writing op-eds. And this kind of goes to a point that we had a few weeks ago. I can't remember what brought this up.
Meritocracy.
About the transferability of credibility. So you become an expert in one field and you show that you have status in that field and people will just buy that you have status everywhere, but your expertise itself is not transferable.
Yeah, just because you've studied really, really hard on a behavioral economics doesn't mean you're an expert in tax policy.
Yeah, or just because you've studied really, really hard on tax doesn't mean you know anything about philosophy. Oh, hang on, I'm looking at myself too deeply right now.
Let's just take it as given that you and I are both elites and everyone should take everything we say as gospel.
Definitely. So that was just an interesting point to see reflected there.
Just as a completely random aside, because that's what I like to do sometimes when Brian talks for
too long. That's what this podcast is totally about, man.
There was apparently a bunch of astrologists who were like theorizing about life on other planets, and they said because they'd done some astronomy and looked at other planets, and this planet's got a bunch of iron or something, and this planet's really heavy, and they did this whole talk about like what alien life could look like. And there was like two or three biologists in the room that are like, nothing you're saying makes any sense at all. You're idiots. You are very good astronomers, I'm sure, but you know nothing about biology and nothing you're saying is even remotely plausible. So just an enjoyable example of like, you think that by being an expert in heavenly bodies, you would potentially be an expert in aliens, but it's like, not really.
No, no. Always fun. Hearing these cross-disciplinary interactions is often fun.
It is often fun. I mean, just I think there's a lot to be gained, but it's hard to do.
Yep. He also mentions in the writing about panel discussions and how panel talks often get many, many more people attending those, like compared to an actual expert presentation.
Yeah, I did like the comparison of when you're in expert mode versus elite mode. And so expert mode is, yeah, when you're presenting your data and your hard findings as an individual, and being in a panel discussion where you're just talking about the topics of a day with a bunch of smart people is when you're in elite mode, just trying to get your opinions out there and be famous and influential.
And I think that kind of also plays to our discussion on the news previously, where there's the hard facts about the news, but then most of the way that it's packaged is actually for entertainment value. And definitely, the way that the media has gone more and more to panel shows and people discussing things as panels. And it's just because it's like people like watching people having flowing discussions. It is more entertaining. It's entertainment value. It's not actually enlightenment value.
Yes, and it is entertaining, and it is all the media that I consume.
Yep, yep.
And it is this podcast.
Thank you. I was about to make that exact same joke, and that's it.
So I'm the funny one. You're the straight man. I'm the funny one. You're not allowed to make jokes.
I'll give it to you then. I wonder what our listeners actually think of that. I'd be fascinated.
No, I think you're pretty funny. I think you get some good jokes in. I just want to be the funny one more than you do.
If people ever actually saw me, they wouldn't think that I was the funny one. I have, like, resting murder face, so.
Yeah, I'm really glad we did this podcast from 3 hours away. A little bit scary.
So rest assured, folks, there is plenty more to say on Robin Hanson's writings. He's got some interesting views on aliens. He's got some fascinating views on
healthcare,
social psychology, I guess, when it comes to signaling theory. But he's a very creative thinker, so I'm sure he'll come back up on the podcast again. Yeah. Take my advice. Read this article, because we're giving you a link to it, but please don't read his other articles without finding a link to them.
Who are we to tell you what to read to read?
Do read them, and if they're good, then link them to me, because that's my filter.
That's a good way to do it. Yeah, listener, if you want to wade through the chaff and you can find a little bit of weed in there for us, that would make our next podcast topic way easier to come up with.
I do enjoy a good Robin Hanson article. There is some genuine like brain sparks that go off when I get them. I just can't go there all the time.
It's coffee bed time.
Oh, he beat me to it. Do I let it ride? Nah.
It's
coffee bed time. It's coffee bed time. And I proposed this one last week.
Yeah, Brian's taken over.
I kind of want to go through the history of coffee beds and see how many I came up with the idea for, to be honest.
I'm not very good at this segment. I'm sorry. I really was relying on the patrons to send the stuff to bed on, and they have once or twice, but it's not as common as I hoped.
Well, there we go. That's a good plug for everyone. If you've got ideas for coffee bets, do send them through. Whether you're a patron or not, we will take them. If you're a patron, you'll get straight to the front of the line, though.
Straight to the top. Straight to the pool room.
There we go. And while we're also on the coffee bets topic, we're trying out a new app. We'll see about getting all our stuff onto there. There were a few developers posted something on the Slate Star Codex Reddit about an app called Melange. Melange?
What is Melange?
I have no idea.
It's a French word, right?
Sure. Oh, while we're talking about words and weird pronunciations, apologies everyone for being such a backwards person and saying rhetoric instead of rhetoric, all right? I'd only ever heard people say the word rhetorical and only read the word rhetoric, or heard someone in England say rhetoric and just assumed that it was like yogurt versus yogurt.
Well, that's what, you know, they always say, don't make fun of people who mispronounce words, because it probably means they read them a lot, and you're a very well-read man. So I tried not to make fun of you on the podcast, although I did make fun of you in the show notes.
Oh man, that's what I get for not reading the show notes this week. So we'll try and migrate our bets across to Melange. You can actually follow us on there. So I have the user ID of @affix, so that's pretty sweet. Nice to get in early to get a sweet.
I'm @podcast, am I?
Are you @podcast? I think you're still using @ChrisMelba.
Oh, do I need to sign up with a different @? Okay. Anyway, it seems like fun for affix to bet podcast.
Then yes, definitely.
People don't know who we are. So it's our growth hacking for the next quarter.
Sure.
Brian's got charts that we have to follow.
I think, honestly, we're probably going to be contributing more to that app than they're contributing to us. But, you know, it's nice to have the symbiosis. I like supporting the new guys. That's why I get Macrobio Boy on the podcast. That's why I get, you know, support small streamers and all that kind of deal.
And Julia Galef, who's only 500
much
times
more
bigger
popular
than 5,000 times bigger than us? 50,000 times bigger than us.
If we're measuring the amount that she is, like, loved,
yeah,
100,000,
yeah.
A million.
People like her on Twitter. People are very, very fan. I like her. I haven't liked her very much on Twitter, but I like her.
Yeah. So Coffee Bet this week. We've talked a lot about the Great Stagnation. And in my mind, one of the things that would be evidence that the Great Stagnation is over would be proper self-driving cars. I can take a self-driving car from Albury in Australia to Melbourne. That's what I want.
Not to Canberra. Obviously not to Canberra. I really thought that maybe you would want to come and visit me with this self-driving car, but no.
I want to cross the state borders, and I don't feel like a territory is enough.
You don't cross any state borders to go to Melbourne, and you cross two to go to me.
Albury.
Oh, you're going to go to Albury to start your journey. Okay, all right, fine.
I mean, I guess, what's another border town you could go to? I guess I could go to...
Chukamauama.
Yeah, Chukamauama. Is there one that, what's the border town in Queensland and New South?
It was on the news a bunch when the border closures, but I didn't remember.
Meh, whatever. Nuts to those Queenslanders.
Yeah, yeah, nuts to those guys. It's exactly how they all sound. Yep.
100%. Hundo P.
Right, so when can you specifically... So, I don't know.
So, sure, if I could take a self-driving car from Albury to Melbourne in Australia and not have to take the wheel until, you know, I will even give it. It doesn't have to get me to my destination in Melbourne. It has to get me to like a central parking lot in Melbourne or whatever where I have to take over and drive. I'll give it that.
Okay. And what about just off the ring road? It starts to beep at you saying, hey, we're about to leave the ring road. You need to pay attention, please.
Nah, it has to park.
Okay. You want it to park so you can have a snooze.
Yep. I want to be able to sleep in the car while it drives itself, basically.
I mean, that would be lovely. Yeah, and that does feel like a breakthrough, right? Breakthroughs in transportation have been a classic innovation in technology. So trains initially, well, maybe horse and carts initially, maybe the wheel initially. Depends how far back you want to go. Trains certainly transform the landscape. Aeroplanes certainly transform the landscape. Big breakthroughs in transport do completely reshape society. The automobile invented the suburbs, right? No one's living in suburbs if they don't have cars to get into work every day. No one's having friends in different countries if they don't have planes to go and visit them. And I agree, a self-driving car feels like it sort of makes travel more free in terms of time, like spending half an hour a day or an hour, half an hour to work and half an hour home from work, or an hour to work an hour home from work is time where you've got to be concentrating on this fairly menial, boring task, but you really have to concentrate because otherwise you kill people. So having that fully automated and you can do some work or you can watch some Netflix or you can literally just sleep, that does actually feel like a really big breakthrough in the technology and will probably reshape society.
Yeah. So that would be a huge pillar in breaking down the Great Stagnation and maybe with like, nah, whatever, Great Stagnation, get stuffed. Unfortunately, I feel like we're still a fair way away from it. Like when I first got into following the self-driving car scene back in like 2011, 2010-ish, I would have been like, yep, 2025, I feel like that's 15 years. I'm hearing things now. Okay. I think it's pretty achievable. And then CGP Grey came out with his video, Humans Need Not Apply, in what, 2013 or something like that?
Isn't that old? Oh, that's hilarious.
And I'd be like, oh, 2020? Yeah, that sounds pretty good. And now I'm sitting here in 2021 and I'm like, 2035?
Yeah. Is it like fusion? It's always 15 years away. I was going to say, if we're making
that's
a bet,
a good point.
I'm just going to go through Elon Musk's Twitter timeline here for a sec. Yep, he promised that Teslas would be self-driving by 2015. So I'm going to say that is the year that you'll be able to do it, Brian.
Interesting.
So 6 years ago.
Maybe they are able and we're just not willing to trust them.
Yeah, just for regulatory concerns, they've disabled that feature.
But that's my bet. I want to be able to do it. When do you think? Rather than just 2015. I've said 2035. Would you bring it earlier? Would you leave it there?
What's 2035? I would take the... it's a hard one. It is a hard one. It does seem perpetually 15 years away. There are some breakthroughs. I think there are some actually driverless taxis in some American states in the world that are run by Google, I believe.
Yep.
I think Apple is working on a car project and they have pretty good engineers, although whether they'll be looking for self-driving or just like a car with leather edges that are no more rounded than 1.5 millimeter radius, who knows?
And just for listeners' sake as well, you have given me good guidance on this in discussions in the past. This is highway driving as well. This is not driving around slowly in a city at 30 kilometers an hour.
Which is really hard.
Like highway driving seems really easy for us as humans, but a mistake in highway driving is catastrophic.
Yes,
a mistake in driving 30K an hour is not necessarily.
Absolutely. Yeah, I can't remember where I came across that point. But yeah, it does seem like Highway Javelin should be the first to go automated because it's sort of like just being on a train and you just follow the lines and it's very easy. But yeah, any mistakes that are made on the highway is catastrophic and probably lethal.
Yep. So that is one thing holding it back, I suppose. So 2035, I'm happy to take
I would take the low side of 2035. If it's going to drive from Albury, so it's going to get through Albury traffic, it's going to get on the highway, and then it's going to get somewhere in Melbourne, possibly on the outskirts to a parking lot. And it's going to be available enough that you can just do it. I'm not going to say you will do it because I just don't think you'll ever leave Albury River again. And then I'll guaranteed lose this bet, but it would be like not a ridiculous imposition for you to do it. I'm not saying that it's like a $700 novelty that one guy will let you do and he sort of sits in the passenger seat and kind of keeps an eye on the wheel. It's just like, yeah, you can pay $50 for your Tesla taxi and it'll take you wherever you want.
Yeah, I should be capable of getting in that car by myself, no one else in there with me.
Yeah, I reckon I want to take the low side of the bet. I don't know whether that's just because I'm optimistic or because I actually believe it's true, but I think there has been progress in the last 10 to 15 years that would indicate that we're more than halfway from 2005, I guess.
Okay. I'm willing to take the long side and let you have the short side because, frankly, if it comes sooner, I will be so happy that I will be willing to pay many more than one coffee.
This is another Brian Hedge. He uses these coffee bets like weapons, I swear. He's running a little fun. There's probably an ETF trading in the background where Brian's making some extra cream, as it were.
Love it.
Whatever. I'll just get taken advantage of. At least I get to drink sometimes delicious coffee and sometimes gas station coffee.
Fresh meat.
Oh, I thought it was a metal section now. I thought you were getting way back metal.
I mean, yeah, what would that be? That'd be death metal, not black metal. I can deal with death. That's all right.
There's a lot of different metals and I don't know any of them.
Yeah, lucky you.
Right, well, I don't have Diablo news, but I have a Diablo question. One of our most recent patrons, I can't believe that an intelligent podcast like ours, where we discuss the big issues of the day, would actually have a section just on a stupid video game from the year 2000. And he wonders what the Straussian reading of Diablo speedrunning is. So for those who don't read Tyler Cohen's blog religiously, Straussian is, there's usually a subtext that the author can't talk about because it's against the norms of society or it's against the powers that be or something. So a close reading of the text will show you that the author's intent is the opposite of what they may be saying in plain English. And so this patron wonders, what's the Straussian reading of all of this speedrunning talk, Brian? And I myself am now deeply curious because if I've been missing a Straussian interpretation this entire time, I'll feel like an idiot.
No, I mean, I made it obvious when Diablo 2 Remastered was announced, which was, we need some silliness on this podcast. We need something that doesn't matter. And sometimes you got to talk about the things that don't. Or is
Brian trying to say that it really does matter?
There is like a discussion, or there was a couple of years ago, about how speedrunners are the people who are out there trying to find the real edges of things, and it's like a real demonstration of the capacity of the everyman to go out there and...
I mean, it's a demonstration of mastery. I think that's a good thing. It's nice to have mastery in your life.
Yeah, but I don't buy into that. This is just silly fun.
Okay, it's just silly fun. You've made so many numbers bigger that it's nice to have a number to make smaller.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. I think that's fair. That's like, rather than a Straussian reading, what are the insights that I get from being into Diablo 2 speedrunning? It's a very international scene. I'll give it that.
Yeah, that's true. Yep, absolutely.
I feel bad that all the speedrunners that I watch are male, and it doesn't make any sense to me. Like, there are actually female streamers of it on Twitch, but female streaming on Twitch is weird. But if they were, like, putting the effort into the game and they were speedrunning, I'd be happy to cover them. It's just none of them happen to be in the top 10 runners, so. If anyone's got any, like, insights into female speedrunners, I'd love to get a link on it or something like that and read about that.
Sure.
I think, didn't StarCraft 2 have all-female team or something like that? Or was that all-female team?
Scarlet, I'm pretty sure, is the ESL champion. Scarlet versus Bomber. If you want a monster StarCraft 2 match to watch, Scarlet versus Bomber in the grand final of the ESL, and Scarlet being a female StarCraft 2 player, amazing game. And she won, and I believe that was the grand final that she won in that game. Spectacular play. She's incredibly talented.
Awesome. All right, cool. So, big news. In Diablo 2 this week.
Always big news. Every week there's big news. It blows my mind how much news there is that somehow doesn't filter into my bubble until Brian tells me.
This one actually got covered on like several news websites, which astonishes me that this story got covered on several gaming news websites. But Mr. Llama SC finally found the unique Archon staff, Mangson's Lesson.
Yep.
In Diablo 2. He has been hunting for every single set, unique item in the game. which I also referenced in the conversation with Microbio Boy. I have found every item except for Tyrael's Mine, which is the rarest item in the game.
You're not that far behind Miss Lamoressi. Is that what you're saying?
Well, finding Tyrael's Mine is a 1 in 300,000 chance.
Right, but have you found the item that he just found?
Yes.
Yeah, right, so you beat him to it.
Well, yeah, but like he had Tyrael's Mine before me. Like it's way rarer. He just got on the bad outcome side. So he's been doing this, what they call in the Diablo community, Holy Grail, for 5 years now. And he would be devoting, like, on average over those 5 years, I would say 5 to 10 hours every week at least. So that's a lot of hours to put into a game. Hours. And, yeah, he ripped off his shirt. He screamed a lot when he found it. He got a lot of extra subscribers and made a bit more money when he found it. But
I mean, sometimes you got to play up to the audience. You did link this to me, so this one did filter through my bubble. Still through you. But yes, he was very excited to find that Archon stick something. Very, very excited. More excited than I've been about almost anything I've been in my entire life.
Yep, that's the news for this week. There's actually a whole bunch of other news, like they're still having races and Kano 1-1 and Ryu 1-1 and all that kind of stuff. But Mr. Llama actually made the news, so there you go.
The real news. Which news? New York Times, I assume. The New Yorker. The New Yorker? Which elite was discussing Mr. Lamoressi? He's pretty charismatic. Is he himself an elite?
He does have a lot of charisma. I mean, I would put him in the elites of Twitch for sure.
Yeah, okay, cool.
I don't know that he's like top rank elite in there.
There's some big Twitch streamers. Ninja's a big one. Thingy-me on YouTube must stream now, surely. What's his name? PewDiePie?
Oh, yeah, PewDiePie. God, it's been a long time since I thought about PewDiePie. I am that out of touch. Mm-hmm. Or maybe I'm in now. Touch. And PewDiePie's old,
maybe
too.
Maybe PewDiePie's, yeah, old school. He's been around a long time.
So that's the Diablo 2 news this week. We'll put a link in the show notes if you want to watch a guy scream a lot and take his shirt off.
This is one of the few ones that I would recommend watching, listeners. Although I have spoken to a few of our listeners, and a lot of you have just switched the podcast off by now.
Well, whatever. You're missing out on just silliness, so it's your loss.
It's your loss. It's
maybe you're listening to a different podcast that's actually done by comedians.
That might be better.
Opportunity cost everywhere.
Yep. You had to try to make the Diablo section smart, didn't you?
Hey, you brought in Straussianism. Come on.
I didn't. I'm just here on behalf of our glorious patrons.
Yeah, all right. Fair enough. Thank you, patron. So, yeah, no. Thanks for hanging out with us this week, folks. It was a good one. Silliness. Robin Hanson. I don't know. Whatever. We'll see you next time.
See you next week.
I just feel like linking that quote just on Reddit now. /I am very smart.
Maybe one of our listeners will do it for you. It's copy bit time. Just in case Brian edits all of that out, I got in first this time, listeners, and if he edits this out again, I'll be very upset.
I'm going to edit that second one in that you did at the end.
I enjoy that we now communicate through podcast edits and show notes.